So please feel free to ask questions at any time during the talk, interrupt, and so on. We will start by talking about the simplest spherically symmetric solution of Einstein's equations, which is the Schwarzschild solution. Okay. Schwarzschild solution has a Penrose diagram, which has this form. Should I explain Penrose diagrams? Everyone knows what this diagram means? Okay. So we have the two singularities. We have two exterior visions. The right exterior and the left exterior. Let's say, future and past interiors. It took a while to understand this solution. It's a kind of the history is amusing, how different people found various parts of the solution. Eddington wrote some coordinates where you could describe smoothly the inside and the outside, but didn't even remark that on the paper. It just wrote that in a paper that was about something else. Einstein, Lemaître showed that you could go through the horizon and, in a smooth way. Einstein and Rosen found that if you take this spatial slice, it connects the two sides, but they thought that T00 was singular at the horizon because it was in those coordinates. They hadn't read the previous papers which had coordinates which where that was non-singular. An interesting history. Would it happen now? I don't know. Maybe also maybe there are papers we don't read and we're still confused about some things. This solution is time translation invariant, which is, of course, SU2 invariant, SO3 invariant. And I'm not drawing the two sphere, right? On each of these points, there is a two sphere. Roughly, this is like a time direction, and this is a space direction. Here at infinity, we have a space which is just Minkowski space. And Minkowski space far away has a time translation symmetry. And that time translation symmetry, when you look at this region, it moves points along this type of trajectories. Okay? And a crucial point about black holes, and well, especially this solution, is that the time translation symmetry, what is asymptotically a time translation symmetry, is a symmetry everywhere in this space-time, but acts at this point as a boost. Right? So it translates times forwards in this direction, times backwards in this direction, and around this point, it acts as a boost symmetry. Okay, in particular, here, it acts as a spatial translation. So it's like, these regions here look like a bit like a cosmology, it's an isotropic cosmology, where there are the two directions of the sphere, and then one direction, which is the direction that was time-like outside, now here is space-like, and the whole solution is invariant under translations in that solution. That direction. That's an isometry of the solution. Now, one might be confused by the fact that here it looks like we're evolving things backwards in time. This is the symmetry of the solution, but we could think of this as a solution where time moves forwards everywhere. So there is a well-defined sort of time direction and so on. But the solution is time-dependent. Right. So we have. Suppose you start at t equal to zero with this particular slice. You can evolve the equations. You can evolve to the future, and you find this geometry. But it's a time-dependent geometry. So somehow this region that connects the two sides is stretching in the time direction. In what was the time direction here, in that direction of the isometry, and is shrinking in the two sphere directions. Right? Okay, now this is a solution that you could say it's a bit like a wormhole in the sense that this slice has a shape of this form. So this slice has this type of shape. This is the so-called Einstein-Rosen bridge here. But it's time dependent. So if you draw the same slice at a later time, this neck connecting would be longer and thinner. Okay. You draw it a little later, it's even longer and even thinner. Okay. So that's this original solution. Now we'll talk about a closely related solution. So imagine that we have this slice, but imagine that we consider a situation where we have two black hole exteriors, and we connect them to each other as they are connected here in this region, right? Or as they are connected in this space, right? So here, these two R3s are two separate three-dimensional space, but we could imagine that they are connected far away, right? And so we have two black holes that are connected through the interior. And we can find initial data that obeys the constraints at t equal to zero, that where the space-time geometry has this shape, and then we can evolve that to the future. And well, the black holes in the outside, they will attract a little bit, perhaps. They might be orbiting, they might be doing various things. And in the inside, they would have an evolution similar to this one. Okay. So the point is that this solution that contains the two black holes in the same space near this region, and near the region that connects the two, also will have this shape. Okay. So general relativity has this solution where you could have two black holes that could be separated by a big distance, let's say 1 million light years. But if you are, let's say, 1 meter outside of this black hole, and your friend is 1 meter outside the other black hole, then your separation in the ambient space could be 1 million light years, but your separation through the wormhole could be very small. So one would be here, and the other one would be here, right? And they were separated by a short distance. Okay, now this seems to, one might be worried that this might lead to a violation of the principle of relativity. So the principle, one of the principles underlying special or general relativity is that you cannot send signals faster than light, right? And naively you might think, oh, perhaps I can send a signal through this wormhole. Yes?
So I have a question between those two solutions.
Yeah.
So the second one, yeah. In principle, I could go from one of the mouth of one black hole to the other, walking the 1 million light years.
Yes.
But in the Schwarzschild solution,
in this one, no, you cannot.
That is
a difference. Yeah. Well, the idea here, the reason I'm saying that they are similar is because this is a very long distance. So to the extent you can neglect this distance, then they are similar. Okay. It is like this one, but you connect them far away, like this, right? Yeah. We'll later talk about what happens when this distance becomes smaller. So I choose 1 million light here because like outrageously large distance. Even though they are, if these two observers stay outside the black hole following these trajectories, right? They are, of course, accelerating observers. Then they cannot send a signal to each other, right? Because if you send the signal, the fastest it can travel is at the speed of light. And at the speed of light, the signal will go like this. And it's pretty close to the horizon here, but it's behind the horizon. So it cannot get to the other side. So now, OK, so in this solution, we see that it cannot get to the other side. But it's only by it misses by epsilon, right? By something very small. So you might think that, oh, maybe I could just modify the solution a little bit, keeping still a solution, but where you can send the signal. Okay. I wonder where this is possible. So for example, you can send some extra matter. You can have some perturbation of the solution. And you might think, well, the solution can be perturbed either one way or another way. And you're naively, you might think that you could do it. But actually, there is a theorem saying that you cannot do this. So that if you have any solution, as long as the matter inside, so it could be Einstein theory coupled to matter, but as long as the matter obeys a certain energy condition that we're going to fully explain in a second, but roughly speaking is the null energy condition, then you cannot do it. So this is a theorem that says that there are no science fiction wormholes, right? Now, science fiction wormhole, it's a solution where that would allow you to travel faster than light through the wormhole. But you travel through the wormhole, and effectively you are traveling faster than light in the ambient space. So you have some wormhole in some ambient space with some well-defined, let's say, speed of light and notion of causality, and then you can go faster than the speed of light through the ambient space. That's a science fiction wormhole. Okay. So the idea is that these ones are not allowed. So let me just say under which assumptions they are not allowed, be very explicit. So the first assumption is Einstein's equations. And the second assumption is a condition on matter. So it's the so-called average, the achronal average null energy condition. Okay. So let me explain each of the words, what they mean. So let me start with null. So this means that we are going to take the components of the stress tensor along a null direction. Okay. So that was what null meant. And the condition is, so classical theories obey that this is locally positive. And average means that we're going to integrate over an infinite line that goes from plus to minus infinity, this null energy. So this could be a line so let's imagine there was a wormhole that allowed a signal to travel, then it would be a line that enters through one wormhole and goes through the other wormhole. Let's say that would be an example. And then goes all the way to infinity. We integrate that, and we assume we want the idea is that this should be positive. That's the condition. That's the work condition. And achronal means that this null line is just not any null line, but it's the fastest null line in this spacetime. So there are no two points on this null line that are time-like separated. Now you can have situations where we are not talking about the fastest null line. So for example, we all saw the pictures of the Event Horizon Telescope, right? So there you can have null rays that go around the black hole a few times, right? That's a null line, but it's not the fastest null line that go. There is a faster way to go between. Suppose you have some star far away and there is light that does something like this, let's say. You could also go far away from the black hole and let's say reach us, and that would be a faster way to go. So this is in general a line that goes through some massive body gets slowed down a little bit, so it's not the fastest null line. But if we had a line that went through a wormhole that is a science fiction wormhole, then it will go faster than the lines that live in the ambient space. So it would be an achronal line. And the idea is that for all such lines, the matter, ordinary quantum matter, obeys this condition. I should emphasize that in quantum field theory, T++, the expectation value of T++ at some point, can be negative. So can be negative, or what can be negative. And it can be arbitrarily big. So at a given point, it can be negative and arbitrarily negative. Mm-hmm. It's only after you integrate that you get something positive. So this is, let's say, I put it as an assumption, but this is a condition that can be proven for field theory, in quantum field theory in flat space, and in some simple geometries like the Schwarzschild geometry. And it's believed to be valid, and of course there are no counterexamples to this condition. When you can prove it, you prove it under the assumptions that you have a relativistic quantum field theory. So somehow the special relativity and quantum mechanics implies this condition. So it's interesting that an energy condition is implying some result about causality. It's a bit non-trivial. I mean, it's non-trivial that these two should be related. Okay. Now, I emphasize that you cannot send signals if you remain outside, but you could meet in the interior if you jump in, right? So, if you and your friend are here, then you can. If you jump in, you meet in the interior. Okay, and this is something exotic from the. From the point of view of these observers, right? So they're very far away. Each jumps into their respective black holes, and nevertheless, they meet in the interior. So that's the sense in which this wormhole is small, and this interior region is common to both black holes. You can enter it from any side. OK. So that's geometry, right? This is just the solution of GR. It's the simplest solution, the first solution that was found, and we're trying to discuss it. Now I'll try to. One thing I should emphasize is that. So here we have two black holes, but if you find two black holes in the universe, they are not necessarily going to be described by this solution. So, because black holes in our universe are made by the collapse of stars, and when you collapse a star, the Penrose diagram looks more like something like this. So this is r equal to zero in the diagram, the center of the star, and this is the, let's say, surface of the star. So here outside, the solution is the same as the Schwarzschild solution. Inside is different because there is matter, and the sphere collapses smoothly here at r equal to zero. And this is a situation of a star that might be a slowly imploding star, where here the horizon forms, and this region is behind the horizon. Right? And that's so it has only this has only one exterior, right, and only a piece of the whole interior. Is that clear? Okay. Okay, now we're going to start discussing some quantum aspects of black holes. And the key assumption that, I'm going to write it as an assumption, but there is a lot of evidence for this assumption. So this is the key assumption about black holes in quantum mechanics and with quantum gravity, is that if you have a black hole, right, and you view it from the outside, so you stay just outside the black hole and you do all kinds of experiments from outside the black hole, let's say it could be from the asymptotic region and so on, then this black hole can be described by a unitary quantum mechanical theory. And you need a number of qubits which is of order the black hole entropy, so area over 4 g Newton qubits to describe, okay? And of course, this is will be a system at finite temperature with a temperature equal to the Hawking temperature, okay? The Hawking temperature of the black hole. What is the evidence for this assumption? In string theory, so you can count the entropy of some black holes, let's say extremal black holes, and it agrees with the results, with the Bekenstein-Hawking result, and it's you relate explicitly the counting of the entropy to the counting of some microscopic configurations of, let's say, brains or some objects in string theory, and you get the correct answer. So that's one line of evidence that this entropy should be, that the area of the horizon should be interpreted as the entropy of some quantum system. Okay. Another evidence are these holographic dualities, where you have certain spaces, like, for example, ADS space, but there are also some other examples. So you have ADS space, and you can relate all of the physics in ADS space to a theory that lives on the boundary. Okay. And in that case, if you had a black hole inside, you could also describe it as a hot fluid, some fluid at finite temperature in the boundary theory. Okay, so that's for a black hole as seen from the outside, but what about when we have two black holes? So this solution with these two-sided solutions exist basically for all black holes that have a finite temperature. So similar thing exists for charged black holes, for black holes in anti-Sitter space, for rotating black holes in flat space, rotating black holes in any space. So whenever you have a finite temperature, you have a structure that near the horizon you have the time translation asymmetry, which looks like time translation far away, behaves as a boost. And in the ADS case, the Penrose diagram of these black holes has this shape, and I'm probably going to discuss now just this ADS black hole. So that's the same as the standard Schwarzschild solution, but with asymptotically ADS boundary conditions. Now, the idea is that these solutions that so these basic solutions where they are connected through the interior, like the eternal Schwarzschild solution, should be viewed. So you can view each black hole viewed from the outside is some system that has it's at finite temperature and has this entropy, right? But the idea is that the two together should be viewed as two entangled quantum systems. And they're entangled in a particular state, which is the thermofield double state. And if you know each of the systems, each system will have its own energy spectrum for the left system and the right system. And you sum over all the states in the spectrum with a particular factor, which looks like a thermal factor, right? So this particular entangled state has the property that if you trace out the left side and you get the density matrix on the right side, then the density matrix on the right side will be just the thermal density matrix. Okay. That's why we have these factors. And this, so this state, this is a state that has had been considered previously in the study of thermal field theory. And Werner Israel was the one, the first one to make this connection. At least there's a zeroth order consistency check. Is the idea that, it's just the check that using this wormhole, you cannot send signals. And also, using entanglement, you cannot send signals. So that property that you cannot send signals is compatible with this identification. Now, why would one think that this is true? So, let's go back just to the Euclidean black hole. So let's consider, so Euclidean black hole is what you get by taking, let's say, the Schwarzschild black hole, and you view this as a time direction, and then you make this time direction Euclidean, right? You take this t to it. When you do that, you find that the geometry has the following shape. So you can, if this is the radial direction, so r is the direction which moves you away from the horizon. So we have some, let's say, r direction, and this was the t Lorentzian time. Let's say the time t, and then we have some Euclidean time tau. So in general, if you did that, you get some geometry like this with a conical singularity. But if we adjust the period of tau appropriately, then we get this, a solution that has no singularity here at the horizon. Okay. Now, just to explain why that could be the case, let's go back to this picture of Minkowski space. So locally, the spacetime near this point is looks like ordinary Minkowski space, and then we can go from Lorentzian time to Euclidean time by, let's say, continuing the, let's say there is some direction x0, and we can take x0 to I, the x0 Euclidean, okay? And if you do that, now you go to Euclidean space. And that's, of course, the same space that you would get by analytically continuing this time coordinate t, the other analytic continuation I was mentioning. But so when you do that, so now in Euclidean space, what before were these hyperbolas of fixed r, now are circles of fixed r, right? And so we get circles. We get these circles here in the on the plane, right? So we get some small circles here and, well, some bigger circles as you move away. So this is just a picture of flat space. And that's how it looks near the center. And that's how also this picture looks near the origin. It looks basically like flat space, right? But when you go out for larger values of r, the circles that start growing around this point start having bigger and bigger sizes. At some point, their sizes stabilize and have some constant size. Okay. That's simply the fact that g00 or gtt, just the time component of the metric, was zero at the horizon, but is non-zero, let's say, equal to 1 at infinity. Okay, very good. Now, of course, this particular period that you need to choose at infinity is the inverse temperature of the black hole, right? Because when you have when Euclidean time is finite, that's the Euclidean picture for a system at finite temperature, right? So we are doing evolution Euclidean time with some Hamiltonian, so we are calculating trace e to the minus beta h. Right? Okay. And the fact that these circles are becoming smaller and smaller as you approach this point is related to the fact that an observer who sits at a fixed proper distance here will see higher and higher proper temperatures. Right? The proper temperature he would measure is higher and higher and goes to infinity as you go to the center. When you redshift that temperature to a temperature that you see outside, you see a constant constant temperature, which is what we call the Hawking temperature. Okay. This is a general feature of thermal equilibrium in a gravitational field that, even if you have a gas of air in this room, if you put a thermometer up here and a thermometer down there, which thermometer you think records a higher temperature? Or should they record equal temperature? It's in thermal equilibrium. So we have just a column of gas in thermal equilibrium here in this room. No guesses? Okay, let's do a boat. So we have the gas. We put a thermometer here, right? Would be a thermometer here. There is a gravitational field, of course, of the Earth. And the question is whether this one is hotter than this one. Well, this is what I said, but maybe it's wrong. So it's in thermal equilibrium. So isn't in thermal equilibrium, isn't the condition of thermal equilibrium that the thermometer should measure the same temperature? Either you learn something wrong in physics, or I'm saying something wrong. Okay. Imagine you have some molecules, right? They are moving with some speed here, right? But if they have to reach up there, they will lose some energy climbing the gravitational potential, right? So you expect them to move a little slower up here, right? Here they have more potential energy. So if you include the potential energy term, then if you think of the whole Hamiltonian as being the kinetic energy plus the potential energy, then the temperature is constant. But the thermometers don't care about potential energy, potential gravitational energy. Thermometer would actually measure how molecules are moving around, an actual physical thermometer. And so the physical thermometer will actually see the molecules moving slower here than here, and will record actually a lower temperature here than here. Now, of course, for the Earth, this is very tiny. I don't even know whether it's measurable, probably not measurable. But let's say for stars and stuff like that, that's important. And for the atmosphere of a black hole, it's also important. So here, if you have a black hole in thermal equilibrium, you have imagine you have a gas at the Hawking temperature. So we have a temperature which is constant. And then as you start approaching the horizon and you are sitting at the constant position, right, then the temperature you would measure with your physical thermometer would be higher and higher. This fact that the temperature changes in the gravitational field, I think it's called Tolman relation. Right. Don't take my word for it. I think it's that might be wrong. Good. So this is the Euclidean black hole, and let me draw the same picture of the Euclidean black hole, but viewed from here. Right. So we have something like a disk. So there is the center. So we have the it's basically the same picture that I drew here, but I intend this boundary, this to be a circle far away. It could be a boundary like the ADS boundary, or the boundary of flat space, and so on. And now we can imagine evolving in Euclidean time up to this time, right? And then from this time onwards, we could evolve in Lorentzian time. So from the point of view of the boundary, we are evolving over Euclidean time, which is an interval between 0 and beta over 2. Okay, and if we do that evolution, we would prepare a state in two copies of the system. So when we cut here, we have two boundaries, and we have two copies of the quantum system. And so in each copy, we have these energy levels. And because we evolve by beta over 2, we get this factor phi to the minus beta over 2 en. That's from the boundary point of view. From the bulk point of view, this is a surface of time reflection symmetry. And we can also evolve forwards in time. And the forwards evolution in the the bulk would just give you half of the, for in the case of ADS, it would give you this half of space. So that's basically the argument that this geometry should be described as a thermofield double. Okay. Okay, so now let me give you some application of this for some paradox, some black hole paradoxes. Are there any questions about any of this? Yeah.
The tip of the cigar shape.
Yeah.
Is that the singularity? Or?
No, that's the horizon. There is no singularity in Euclidean space. So in Euclidean space, it's a completely smooth geometry. From some points of view, you could say that this is only the outside. But from some other points of view, which is the point of view I'm taking here, this is in Euclidean space. And at this moment of time, you have both the left and the right side. Right? So the idea is that, let's go back to Minkowski space. Right? In Minkowski space, when we go halfway around the circle, we go from the right side to the left side. So we get both the left and right sides. So by doing this type of analytic continuation I was talking about. Sometimes people say, if you start from the Euclidean black hole and you analytically continue, you only get the outside. That would be true if you take this tau to IT. Okay? But that's not what we are discussing right now. We are discussing doing a slightly different analytic continuation where you get both sides. Okay? I mean, this was discussed as Hartland-Hocking. It's not a new analytic continuation. Okay, so now let me discuss some application of these ideas to the AMPS paradox, so to one of the black hole paradoxes. So first, the goal of what I'm going to explain now is I'm going to explain what the AMPS paradox is, and I'm going to show how thinking about this you could set up a situation where you AMPS would say there would be a paradox, but we'll see how it's resolved in one particular situation. Okay, so we're going to discuss AMPS paradox. They have various paradoxes. This is the paradox in the first paper, so I'm going to call this the AMPS 1 paradox. Okay. AMPS starts from Almeri, Maros, Polchinski, and Soli. And this is a paradox concerning, so imagine you have a black hole. And we said that black hole is equal to a quantum system. So now imagine a black hole that is maximally entangled with some other system. Okay, so the black hole is maximally entangled with, let's say, a quantum computer. So that we have here a quantum. We are trying to explore quantum aspects of black holes, and so we will need a quantum computer to gather all the radiation that comes from the black hole. I'm not telling you how the quantum computer is built, but let's say it's built, and then you will be able to process what comes out, and you're going to try to study this. So here we have some quantum computer. And the black hole is supposed to be maximally entangled with the quantum computer. Okay? That means the entanglement entropy is equal to the entropy of the black hole. Okay? That's what maximally entangled means. Now how could you get to this situation? So you could imagine a black hole that initially was much bigger and evaporated over a very long time, and it emitted more than, let's say, half of its initial entropy. Then, under general arguments, if the emitted state is pretty generic and so on, the combined state of the black hole and the radiation is very generic, then you expect that the radiation that was emitted would be maximally entangled with the black hole that remains. This was an argument by Page. The idea is that if you take a random quantum system, in a generic random state, and that lives in a Hilbert space, which is H1 times, let's say, H2, two Hilbert space that factorizes into two parts. If H2, the dimension of H2 is bigger than the dimension of H1, and you take a random state, you expect that if you look at just only H1, the entropy would be maximal of the density matrix. Right? In H1 will be some density matrix, and the idea is that the entropy should be maximal. This is Page's argument. And if you have some initial state, so this initial state is the initial black hole that evaporated into some radiation plus the remaining black hole. Let's say this is an old black hole. Then the idea is that the old black hole is maximally entangled with the radiation. Then the radiation is collected by the quantum computer, so the the black hole is maximally entangled with your quantum computer. Is that clear? It's clear that you could set this up, right? Okay, so that's the initial configuration. And this, okay, this looks perfectly reasonable. This is what would happen to any system that is emitting radiation and so on, generic system, you expect something like this. But now for a black hole, you also expect something else. You expect that you ask, what is the near horizon geometry of such a black hole? Well, we expect it to be from general relativity. We expect it to be more or less given by the usual Schwarzschild geometry near the horizon. And in particular, this black hole will be emitting Hawking radiation. So there is some mode, let's call it B, of some Hawking mode that will be emitted at some time after this time. And then there is the partner mode that goes inside. And these two are also entangled, right? Now, okay. Now, this mode is supposed to, it's emitting some, let's say, some radiation from the black hole, and you expect it to be part of the black hole degrees of freedom. So when you count the entropy, this is part of the entropy of the black hole. And so when it's emitting, it's carrying away part of this entropy. And so because these degrees of freedom of the black hole are maximally, all the degrees of freedom are maximally entangled with the quantum computer, you can distill in the quantum computer the particular qubit that is entangled with this qubit B. Okay, so in general, this qubit is expected to be entangled with some complicated state, some complicated mixture of all the qubits here on the right, on the quantum computer. But let's distill a particular one, which is the one such that these two are maximally entangled. Okay. So this circle means that they are maximally entangled. I'm going to assume the entanglement is maximal. This also works with entanglement, which is not maximal. But on the other hand, if the geometry is smooth here, then you should also find that these two are maximally entangled. And this comes from saying that we have locally Minkowski space here. And so in Hawking radiation, this bit is entangled with this one. Okay. Now, a property of maximal entanglement is that it is monogamous. So something can be maximally entangled only with one thing. It cannot be maximally entangled with two things. Okay? So this situation is impossible in quantum mechanics if these three qubits live in three separate Hilbert space or in a spatial slice that is common to all three qubits. And naively, they look like they live in a spatial slice that is space-like slides, where they are three separate tensor factors of a full Hilbert space. Okay. Okay. So, so that's their paradox, and so their resolution to the paradox was to say that well, maybe these two are not maximally entangled, and you have some. So then this space would be singular here. You have some kind of firewall. That's why sometimes this is called the firewall paradox. I think it's more correct to say that they pointed out the paradox and then a resolution. The resolution could be wrong, but the paradox is correct. Or the paradox is correct in the sense that it is some paradox that we have to explain. Okay, it's not something that they made a mistake in saying, oh, this is not really a paradox, or maybe it could be this way, or you have to explain how to resolve this paradox. Okay.
So if you have B,
yeah,
maximum time, don't I have to wait the radiation
so
we get to the computer?
This happened before we get to this time, right? We start at the time when the black hole has evaporated by more than half. There is some original black hole.
Okay.
It evaporated a lot, and now we have the final black hole. So this is an old black hole, right? And this old black hole is maximally entangled with your quantum computer. We start at this time when it's already maximally entangled. We're not going to describe the whole process of how it becomes maximally entangled, etc. We're only going to study at one specific time. And that's also important because maybe you could say, I cannot follow the system over very long times. And the paradox does not involve following the system for very long times. It involves looking at the system at some range of times, some relatively short range of times. And with the assumption that the black hole is maximally entangled with something else, which is a reasonable reasonable thing to think. Okay, so I mean, roughly speaking, this entanglement is expected from black hole unitarity, right? And this type of entanglement is expected from the smoothness of the horizon, and the two seem to be incompatible. Yes?
I would assume that the quantum computer is able to measure every type of collision,
right? Yes. The quantum computer is infinitely powerful in this discussion. Yeah. There were some people that tried to get out of this paradox by assuming the quantum computer is not infinitely powerful, and there are some. So that's also, well, I mean, that might be also an important element. I'm going to assume that the quantum computer is infinitely powerful for this discussion. So this is, since this is a paradox that involves maximally entanglement, let's assume that the original old black hole that we had is actually maximally entangled with another black hole, another equal black hole, right? I mean, in principle, if this quantum computer is all-powerful, we could here collapse the state into a new black hole and manipulate it in order to make it maximally entangled in precisely the thermofield double, right? Thermofield double is not exactly maximally entangled because of the thermal factors, which are less than one, but it's close enough for this discussion. Okay. Also here, I oversimplify the discussion, so this discussion can also be held with things that are not quite maximally entangled, but close. So then in this situation, what is the spacetime geometry? Well, we have, we had the original black hole, let's say, if we draw it like this, let's say this is the black hole that we originally had. And then this is the quantum computer, but that's now another black hole. So this is the initial old black hole, and this is the black hole in the quantum computer. Okay. And now we have these three qubits. So let's see. So we had, I think I inverted the direction of the drawing. So let me just say that the quantum computer is to the left. Okay. This is the black hole in the quantum computer, right? This was the initial old black hole. And so here we had the mode B and A, right? And then we had the mode B tilde. Now, where is B? So B tilde should be some mode that lives in the quantum computer, okay? And when you have this thermofield double, or just ordinary flat space here, things here that look thermal are entangled with things here, right? And they look thermal only because we are forgetting about the left side. But all of them form, I mean, both together form a pure state. Okay. Then we can boost this forwards in time. This may be backwards in time. So the mode B tilde is some mode that lives here. Okay. So this mode up here is entangled with the mode down here. Okay. They, in some boosted frame, which is an isometry of this metric, they live on the same spatial slice and they are across the horizon, so they're entangled with each other. Okay. Is that clear? It's crucial that the mode B tilde is there, okay, in this picture. So then we see that there is something funny here, because here there is no contradiction, because the mode B is entangled with B tilde, and E is also entangled with A, but A is to the future of B tilde. Okay, and when one mode is this problem with maximal entanglement is only present when the three are in three separate tensor factors of the Hilbert space. But if one is to the future of the other, then there is no problem, right? This could just come from the time evolution of the previous mode. But it's not a time evolution in the exterior space. It's a time evolution through the interior. Okay? So through the interior, this mode is to the future of B tilde. Okay? So that's the point. So at least in this for this particular entangled state, we resolved the paradox. We said that we said exactly how these three things managed to be entangled, and the way that it was resolved is that there is a non-trivial causal connection between the interior modes and the exterior. Okay. Yeah.
You said A is to the future of B tilde.
Yeah.
Earlier, weren't you saying that on the left wedge, time runs backwards?
Well, that's the direction of the isometry, right? So, okay, let's say something simpler. Let's say we're in Minkowski space, right? And then in Minkowski space, we look at the action of a boost. Okay, so the action of a boost moves points forwards here and backwards here, but we don't normally say that. I mean, we don't evolve with a boost operator. So we are evolving with the, let's say, the usual time evolution operator. So it is a symmetry of the state, but doesn't imply that the time is ordered differently on one half of Minkowski space, right? Time is ordered however it's ordered in Minkowski space. So here we are taking the same point of view that when we have the two black holes, there is it's a time-dependent solution if you evolve with the time where the both times move forward. If you evolve one time forward and the other backwards, then it's a time it's a symmetry. So here, for example, when we build the state this way, there is a Hamiltonian for the left system and also a separate Hamiltonian for the right system, and there is no interaction between them. So we could evolve with a Hamiltonian, which is just the sum of the two. We could put any two coefficients that we want. We could also imagine, well, the isometry B, or the Bose symmetry, corresponds to evolving, maybe with a minus here, to evolving forwards on the right side and backwards on the left side. So if we apply this operator to this state, we get an e to the minus I omega from e to the minus i en t, let's say we evolve with some parameter alpha. So we are applying e to the I minus I alpha b to this state. So we get this for the right, and then we get the opposite sign. We get minus en alpha, one from the right and one from the left, and they cancel, and so the state is invariant. Okay. So that's how you show that the this state is invariant under the same isometry that the full solution was invariant under, right? So that's one check also of this relationship. Okay, so now this is not the full resolution of the paradox, because we are not saying how the paradox is resolved when the two black holes are entangled in the most generic state. So for that, we will need to understand when you have the most generic state, how does the connection between the two sides looks like. And that we don't know. We do know that if you modify the state a little bit, you tend to get states or black holes where the wormhole is a little longer. So there is there was a nice discussion by Stanford and Schenker where they send in certain shock waves, and then they fill this wormhole with some kind of matter, and then there is a separation between the left and the right side. Okay. So the idea is that when you complicate the entanglement pattern between left and right, the two get more separated. And when it's as simple as possible, then the two horizons touch, right? So this is like an extreme situation.
Yeah. Are there any ideas of how we look at this picture in scenario two astrophysical black holes with some common origin?
Yeah, so two astrophysical black holes are not maximally entangled. So the picture for two astrophysical black holes is two separate two black holes. So it's the picture we drew before. So this discussion is irrelevant, as far as I know, for astrophysical black holes. Okay, that's the geometry, and that's the end of the story. Right. So this discussion is only relevant if we want to understand very old black holes where quantum effects are very important, and so on. So that's the only case where it's relevant. And so it might be relevant for black holes that are dual to, let's say, some systems you can build in the lab, or things. This would not be black holes that are governed by our known four-dimensional gravity theory, but some other effective gravity theory. Okay, any other questions? So as I said, it does not resolve it in general, but at least it points out that an important lesson is the following, that when we talk about doing very complex quantum mechanical operations, we cannot neglect the space-time generated by the quantum mechanical operation. Okay. So let me emphasize this point, because I think it's very important. So let me discuss, just to make this clear, let me just discuss a related paradox. So I think it's a paradox that is similar in flavor. It's not exactly the identical paradox. But if you have, that is the Maxwell demon. So you have a hot gas here and a cold gas here, right? And you have a little demon here that when it sees a hot molecule, it closes the door. And when it sees a particular one that has low velocity, it lets it go through. Right? And in this way, it can get this hotter and hotter and this colder and colder. Okay. Okay. So this is a particular setup that apparently violates the laws of the second law of thermodynamics. Okay. And it's violating the second law because we're not taking into account the entropy generated by the daemon. Okay, so if you include the entropy generated by the daemon, then there is no violation of the second law. Okay? So the daemon has, well, you probably all know the resolution, so the daemon has to write somewhere, whether it, well, it has to have some computer in order to be able to compute the velocity, and the computer has to start in a clean slate, and then after the computation, it's in some mess, and then it's generating some entropy. Okay, so now, so that's for this issue, and here we have some also some problem where we seem to have some kind of violation of unitarity and some violation of general relativity and so on, and the paradox is resolved in this particular case by taking into account the space-time connections or somehow the space-time that the quantum computation computation generates. Okay. So if we had a quantum computation that produced a black hole perfectly entangled with this one, it created some new region of space-time that is connected to the previous one, okay, to the one of the original black hole. And when we talk about black hole interiors and so on, it seems important to have into account, to take into account these connections, at least in this particular example. And for thinking about the black hole information paradox and so on, you need to take into account the space-time generated by the quantum computation. Here, space-time is like the analog of the entropy here. So here was the entropy of the particular computation that was generated. Now here, when you start doing quantum manipulations, you generate some space-time, and you have to include it. Okay. That's the end of the Amps paradox. How much longer do you want to go? I now was planning to discuss traversable wormholes. Well, I still have some time to go, wherever.
Have time,
or well, whenever you get tired, walk out.
Hours.
What?
We have this room for another hour. So.
Ah, okay. Okay, fine.
If someone needs to go, they can go.
Okay, yeah. So I won't be offended if you want to leave. okay, so what I'm going to discuss right now is the topic of traversable wormholes, so something that was pointed out in a very nice paper by Gao, Jeffries, and Wall. And so we'll discuss that. And there is some connection with quantum teleportation and so on. Okay, so now it turns out that you can. We started the talk by saying that if you have some kind of wormhole that connects two regions of space-time, right? And you can travel faster through the wormhole than through the ambient space, then that was forbidden, right? But imagine it's more like this. So imagine that it takes longer to go through the wormhole than through the ambient space-time. Then is that forbidden or not? Okay. Well, it's important to remember that the dangerous thing is the light ray that goes through here, okay? Now, it's interesting that this light ray, let me just first say something. If you have a space-time that connects this way, then there should be some negative null energy here. And there should be some negative energy, null energy here due to the so-called Rachel-Dury equation. That's the equation you actually prove for this theorem, saying something like R++. It comes from this component of the Einstein equation. And it basically says that if you have some light rays that are expanding, then the derivative of that expansion is proportional to minus the stress tensor. And so so light rays tend to focus, right? So if they initially were contracting, they will continue to be contracting. Okay. So here we have light rays coming from infinity, coming into this neck. So they are initially contracting. And they cannot come out of the other side. They will have to change to expansion. Okay. So from that geometry property, you conclude that there should be some negative energy here, negative null energy. Now, is that forbidden? Okay, well, let's see. So we have this null ray that goes through the geometry, and the null ray. So it would be forbidden if the null ray is achronal, right? So the whole integral over this whole thing has to be negative for this geometry to exist, but this null ray is not achronal because you can send if you can send the signal faster in this setup where this is very long. By long, I mean it takes longer to go through the wormhole than through the ambient space. Then the light ray that doesn't go into the wormhole arrives to infinity faster. Okay, so this means that these lines, this line is not a chronon. It's not the fastest null line, this space-time. So then this is allowed. So it's allowed in the quantum theory. It was forbidden in the classical theory. It's allowed in the quantum theory. And you can in fact generate this type of configurations by considering, by initially starting with two black holes and introducing some interaction between the two black holes. Let's say they are close enough. I said they were not very far. I said before we were then going to consider closer black holes. So then there will be some interaction between the two black holes. And this interaction can be such that the ground state of the interaction is this corresponds to a space-time that is connected in this way. Okay. I won't discuss all the features of this. You can ask if you want. But now I'm going to discuss a simpler case where, this I won't discuss. Okay, I'm going to discuss a simple case that where this interaction is turned on only for a short time. Okay, so we're going to imagine, let's say, two black holes that come close only at some particular time, and so the interaction will turn on only at some special time. Yeah.
Sorry, is the evidence that the back reaction of the light ray will modify the geometry in such a way that you wouldn't get this negative energy?
Because this light ray is not a physical light ray, it's just a mathematical light ray. So you are simply looking at Einstein's equations along some mathematical null line, right? We are not sending an actual light ray. We're just looking at the mathematical properties of the solution. If you wish, we're looking at the Reicha-Durre equation for the expansion and integrating that. So there is nothing physical propagating. Okay, so now let's discuss some option, something that naively is not related to any of this, which is called quantum teleportation. Okay, this was discovered by Bennett and some other collaborators in the 80s. And the idea is the following. So imagine that there are two people that share some entangled state, some entangled qubits. And then, so they share these qubits from the beginning, a long time ago. And then there is someone, then they want to send another qubit. So the task is to send a message. The message is a qubit. And the idea is to send the message to from this side to the other side, right? So naively, if you want to send the qubit, right? Naively, you would imagine that you need an infinite amount of information because you have to say in which direction it's oriented, right? It's basically the qubit can point any point on the two sphere, and so that it's an infinite amount of information. But it turns out that you can do it by having this prearranged entangled qubit. You can send the state of this qubit by just sending two classical bits. So you can only send an amount of classical information, which is two bits. Okay, so four states, four zeros or one. And the process is roughly the following. So you apply here a unitary that thoroughly mixes these two qubits. We'll discuss the properties it should have in a second. And then you get two other qubits, and then you measure them in, let's say, the sigma c basis. Okay. So you measure the spin-ups of these two qubits, and this could be up or down, and this could be up or down. You get two classical bits, and you send information to the person here on the right. And the person on the right applies a unitary that depends on the results of these two measurements. So there are four, a knob with four positions, and depending on the four possible results, applies a different unitary depending on the result, and then here out comes the message. Okay. Now how could this possibly work? Well, U is a unitary that acts on two qubits and sends it to two qubits, right? But it's not any unitary. It has the special property that it can also be viewed as a unitary when you think of these two as control. So for each of the specific answers, you can also view this as a tensor, which is a unitary transformation from this Hilbert space to that Hilbert space, right? So the U can be It's a bit non-trivial that you can find such a U, right? But you can find a U such that for each specific values of the answer, the map between this index and that index is also unitary, right? U is only required to be unitary going this way, between these two and those two. And generic unitaries will not have the property I just mentioned. But there are some special unitaries which do have this property. And if you have a unitary with such properties, then this V is the same U when you view. We kind of rotate it, and we view one of these as the input and the other as the output. Take the inverse of that, and then that cancels the effect of this unitary and gives you back the message. Okay, so then you can view this as first there is a unitary transformation between the message and this qubit, and then here again the inverse transformation. So that's an explanation for how quantum teleportation could work, and so on. Okay. So here is more or less the time where I tell the Romeo and Juliet story. Have you heard me talk about the Romeo and Juliet story many times before? No? OK, so then I'll tell you about the Romeo and Juliet story. So Romeo and Juliet were two young people who liked each other, but their families didn't like each other. Okay. Didn't want them to be together. They hated each other. So they kept one here on Earth, and they sent the other one to some faraway galaxy. Okay, this is sometime in the future. It's not traditional story, but they're the same names. But they allow them to exchange letters and exchange qubit messages and so on. And so then they read this paper of quantum teleportation. And they said, well, look, if we set things up, so let's say Juliet was here, right? And Romeo is on this side. Said, well, why don't you just have a big, big pool, right, of qubits? And we replace the message by Romeo, right? So then Romeo jumps into the pool. He gets, really, this is some big blending machine that mixes Romeo very thoroughly with the water and the spin liquid, and then measures all the spins, OK? And then sends all this information via the messages that were allowed to send some information via the messages, classical internet connection between those radio messages. And then here we get to this machine that we had an equally entangled pool that we made by sharing lots of qubit messages, entangled qubit messages. We pre-arranged that. And then out of this pool will jump out Romeo. Okay. Now, they read the paper, seemed correct, and when they did experiments with few qubits, it worked. But Romeo didn't like the idea that he would jump into the pool and to this blender that would be cut into many little pieces to ensure this property. That this is necessary to ensure the property that this should also look like a unitary in this direction. Okay, it's necessary for him to die this way, and so he. But he was assured that he would be resuscitated here, right? With no memory of having died. Okay, but still, he didn't like it very much. Okay. So then they read this paper of Gao, Jeffries, and Wall. Okay, and so this promised to do this in a different way. So Gao, Jeffries, and Wall basically said the following. So imagine you have that this entangled system is not just two pools of qubits, but they are. You make them into black holes. You make them into two black holes. But we take the black holes to be maximally entangled, the same state that we were talking about before. Now, what would happen in this case? So here, you could. So the entangled state is this geometry, this black hole. Okay? So we send in the message. So this will be the message. Eventually, it will be Romeo, but let's for now send the message. And then the message falls into this black hole, right? So here it's the person that stays here on the boundary would see the message falling into a black hole and getting into the Hawking radiation and getting mixed with the thermalized with the Hawking radiation, disappearing behind the Hawking radiation and so on, right? So the message really fell into the black hole. Then the person at this time collects some amount of Hawking radiation, right? So there might be a machine. So if Romeo is going to jump here, he will leave a machine that will, after some pre-calculated time, will measure the Hawking radiation. It has to be a time that allows him to fall into the black hole and disappear behind the Hawking radiation. Okay. Then the machine will measure the Hawking radiation and send a message to Juliet's side. So Juliet will receive this message. And because the Hawking radiation is entangled between here and here, there is something interesting that you can do. So let me, before we talk about that, let me just remind you of something. So if you have a black hole or you have any thermal system, any system at finite temperature, and you do a unitary transformation, right? You shake the walls of the container, or you have a gas at thermal equilibrium, shake the walls of the container, and so on. You can never gain some energy. Okay, you can never extract some energy from the system. Okay, this is just it's basically a second law of thermodynamics. And but if you know if this system is only thermal because it's entangled with something else that you don't know, and you gain some information of the something about the something else, right? So you could, for example, measure the Hawking radiation, and let's say all the spins are pointing, let's say spin number one is pointing up, the other one is pointing down, and so on. Then you can use this information to actually extract some energy from the black hole, right? So for example, if you have even two simple spins, and you, if the spins are maximally entangled, you look at only one of them, it will be random. So if you apply some magnetic field in some direction, you have as much possibility as increasing the energy as decreasing the energy, right? But if you measure one of them, then you know the one you have is, let's say, pointing up or down. Then you apply the magnetic field in the right direction, and then you can gain, I mean, you gain some energy. The energy is given back to you by. Okay, so so in this situation, by knowing the results of this measurement, what Juliet can do is she can extract some energy from the black hole and send some negative energy pulse into the black hole. So there is negative energy going in. Okay, so the negative energy comes in and will cross this message. Okay, so for this we need to find out what happens to a message when it crosses either positive or negative energy. Right? So before we said that if you have a massive object and you have a light ray that passes near a massive object, the light ray will get delayed a little bit. This is called the Shapiro time delay. It's one of the tests of general relativity. It's important for many things, even like if you have a pulsar and orbiting another pulsar, and when the pulses are going near the one of the neutron stars, there is some small delay and so on. So all of these are. If the energy that you send is positive, it will always be a time delay. So if it was a time delay, this on the other side of this pulse, it will go a little bit deeper into the black hole. But because it's a negative energy pulse, the effect has the opposite. The effect is the opposite. So it's a time advance, and it can pull this message that was inside the black hole. It pulls it out of the black hole. Okay. So that's what you find. So you can have this situation. Now, if this was a two-dimensional situation, then the message would not feel anything special when it crosses this shockwave. It would just go out and not just be outside the black hole. This time displacement, it looks locally like a coordinate transformation. It's not globally something trivial because it allows you to escape the black hole, but locally it looks like something trivial, so you don't feel anything special. Yes? Yes, you need to send the information.
So I don't understand where that is needed.
Okay, so let me first imagine these two black holes as being systems that you have in your lab, right? That have some dual description in terms of black holes. Then the idea is that you measure one of them and you immediately transfer the information to the other. Okay? So that's roughly the picture that I was drawing here. If you want the Romeo and Juliet story with the two different galaxies, then you need to set it up in a slightly more complicated way, where you have to take into account one thing that I haven't explained, which is that when we said that we take this wormhole, right, and we embed it in a single flat space, we have to map the times, the local time coordinate here. We have to map it to some time equal time coordinate on the other side, right? So there is the time in the overall space, right? The time in the overall flat space. But when we join this to this side, there could be a relative time shift between the two sides, right? So that what looks here like the time equal to zero surface is not quite the time equal to zero surface, but it's very late, much later time here. Okay, so it is possible to do that. Maybe alternatively, we could say that equivalently, we could say that we sent Romeo very early and we measure the radiation here. And then Juliet will receive it much later here, and then Romeo will come out. Anyway, so it is possible to set this up in principle. In practice, there are many problems, like the black hole has to be very big and so on. But well, the point is that now, if this is Romeo, Romeo can just go through this whole process and without feeling that he was killed at any point in the process. He never feels that he dies. Okay. And so that's so it really this story about the traversable wormhole is not, well, of course, from the outside you see the same as the quantum teleportation discussion, so that's not surprising, and we sent some classical information and we had an entangled state, so there is no contradiction with anything. What's interesting is this whole story is about the feelings of Romeo, what Romeo feels when he goes into the, through this interior, and how And the idea is that by understanding this better, we'll understand how this region of spacetime is constructed in the quantum theory. So the region of spacetime belongs somehow to the two sides, to the entangled state. It can only be probed by coupling the two sides. It cannot be probed by measurements done purely on one side. I think with this note, I'll just end. And if you have some more questions, maybe you can ask them. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What form would this negative energy take? What form does the negative energy take?
Yeah. So here I said that you collect some Hawking radiation. So Hawking radiation is some field. So it could be a scalar field, it could be a gauge field, whatever. And so you are measuring this, and this will be modes of the same field that you measure on the left side. So that's it's like a depletion of the Hawking radiation. So Hawking radiation normally would have some particles coming out, and you extract those particles, and you leave nothing. You leave them in this lowest energy state, and then that's the energy, negative energy, compared to the Hawking state, the Hadley-Hawking state. Yeah. For this to be a very macroscopic state to transport a person, it's not something that can be done in practice in nature, but you can imagine situations where there is a large number of fields, like simple toy models, like the so-called SYK model that has a behavior very similar to what we discussed here. So there, if you send in, let's say, some fermions from here, they will emerge here in a way that is consistent with this bulk picture. So, yeah.
You said it's important that it takes a long time. What would change in this picture if I tried to show
them
that time?
Yeah. Well, here you had to send the signal between Romeo and Juliet, right? So that gives you some time for, right? I mean, that gives you one time, and it takes longer because Romeo has to jump in earlier, right? And he will be taken out later. So it takes longer for Romeo to travel than for the signals to travel between the two sides. Yeah.
So is this possible also if you have the asymptotically
flat
Minkowski?
Yeah. Yeah, in principle it is possible. It's a little easier to discuss in the ADS case, but yeah. In the asymptotically flat space case, you can actually build a solution that is a solution for the standard model Lagrangian that looks like this, a long traversable wormhole. But it's very microscopic because you need, the overall size of the solution has to be smaller than the inverse mass of the W boson. So smaller than the electroweak scale. But you could, in principle, have a solution like this. It's just a solution of the equations. I'm not claiming that it can be easily be made and so on. So that's a fun solution that exists in flat space.
Is there any hint of stability of those solutions?
Yeah, the solutions are locally stable. They are not, they're well, the one we discussed involved magnetically charged black holes with positive and negative magnetic charge. And so they attract each other. So they will have to be orbiting, and they will lose some energy. So they are just, they live for some time. No, they're not infinitely long.
So if
the
electron is in a fundamental level, what is this, or what do you think this is telling us? Or how is this helping us understand?
I think this discussion somehow helps us understand how this interior region is constructed. That is a property not of each of the two sides. So the exteriors are properties of each of the two sides taken individually. The interior is something that comes out of the entanglement of the two sides. And by doing operations by considering operators that act on both sides, we can explore somehow this interior region. For example, here, Romeo was able to explore part of what was the interior before and report, OK, yeah, I saw a smooth interior. I didn't see any firewall or whatever. The goal is to understand better the interior, eventually getting into, well, maybe we expect some singularities here at the inner horizon. This picture is for close to the pictures for near extremal black holes. So we expect some kind of singularity, and eventually we'd like to understand the singularity.
A little bit further back.
Yeah.
To the Ames paradox.
Yeah.
I drew a picture in which the wedges did not connect.
Yeah.
And that is supposed to help solve the paradox.
Yeah, so if the generic state was... this we don't know this to be true, but imagine that the generic state is a very long wormhole, right? OK. Then your mode B is somewhere here. Your A is somewhere here, right? Your B tilde... would be some mode that you can construct in principle from the left side, but it can be it's this mode here, right? But it's very deep inside the interior and it's hard to construct it. So if you do simple operations here, like manipulating the Hawking radiation in a simple way and so on, then that's equivalent to sending signals here that don't affect the A tilde. Okay, so maybe I should first. There are some other Amps paradoxes. So I talked about Amps number one. There is Amps number three and four, etc. Two, three, and four, which are in the second paper. This numbering is not. So what they say is that okay, if you intend to solve the paradox by saying that this mode B tilde is in the past. Then maybe if you just change the state of that mode by acting with a unitary or sending some small perturbation and so on, this perturbation will come in and will hit this person A. Right? I mean, it will change the state of this mode A, and so it will produce something that effectively looks like a firewall. But if there is a resolution along these lines, then which we don't know yet, the idea would be that simple operations that you do here on the left, okay, send signals, but they send signals that remain here far from this region of the wormhole. If you want to send a signal that affects the state of A, then you have to do a very complex operation. You have to essentially shrink this wormhole or something similar in order to get to this point and then be able to send the signal. So that's the idea. We don't know where this is the right resolution because we don't know what the generic wormhole looks like. That there is another. If we want me to speculate a little more or other possibilities, so you could take the point of view that these wormholes are only well defined when you have certain specific patterns of entanglement. They are not you cannot assign a geometry or even close to geometry or even a quantum geometry to a generic state, generic entangled state. Those can be assigned only for those that have very special patterns of entanglement, and well, that's a logical possibility. In that case, the geometry would emerge only in some cases. But yeah, still you can ask, well, what's the generic picture? Maybe they're not even connected. Maybe you come in and it spreads into like little tiny quantum threads, but how deep is this distance? So that someone who falls in late, will he see or she see anything from this region? Well, with Lenny Susskind, we had this idea that maybe for any entangled system, we have some kind of microscopic space-time, microscopic little wormhole connecting them. And then in some situations, when you put lots of things together to form black holes, all these little microscopic things build a big classical wormhole. It's only a vague idea because we don't know the rules for quantum gravity for very tiny little Planckian-sized wormholes. So it's more like a principle that perhaps quantum gravity could obey. So it's still a challenge to construct a theory of quantum gravity that would obey this principle. We called it ER equal to EPR. I'm not sure if we said that. There were two papers by Einstein and Rosen, one with Podolsky also, that they wrote more or less in the same year. One on the Einstein-Rosen bridge and the other on EPR. Okay. Another question? Okay, well, see you. And best wishes for your studies.